Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
And now I'm talking with David Johns, who is president of the board of the Wildlands Project, an organization that a lot of you are going to want to know a lot more about, many of you do already know about. He's also professor of politics at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. David, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been following this debate, and you teach politics. Your perspective would be very welcome. So let's first of all get your reactions.
Well, first of all, I welcome the debate. I have a couple of thoughts about the paper and also about what I consider to be the two biggest obstacles that conservationists or environmentalists face. And I frankly think a lot more about conservation, the protection of wildlife, of ecosystems, than some of the other issues. That's my emphasis, just so your listeners know that.
You know, David, give us a little heads up on the Wildlands Project, because not everybody knows. That will help frame your discussion better.
Well, sure. The Wildlands Project is an effort to create a system of protected, connected protected areas across North America that would be capable of supporting all native species, all ecological processes in perpetuity. So what we're really trying to do is figure out how best to protect and recover the biological health of North America, and to try to ensure that that continues. That involves, of course, not only understanding the biological science, but also trying to understand the political science of accomplishing these goals.
You're literally aiming for an unbroken biome between Canada and Mexico.
Well, we work throughout North America, so we work really from the Arctic all the way down to Mesoamerica. We recognize that ecological systems and ecological integrity and the survival of species depends on protecting things at lots of different scales. So species, individual animals, individual communities, but those communities are also interrelated, and even continents, we're finding out, are in a sense systems themselves, as well as, of course, the globe in its entirety. So it's really important to try to understand what's going on at all of these different levels and the way they interpenetrate, and to try to problem solve then at the appropriate level.
Well, of course, the paper raises the issue that the environmental organizations in the United States are failing to a large degree. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I certainly agree that we are nowhere near achieving what we need to achieve to be moving in the right direction. The environmental movement, the conservation movement, well, we certainly have won some battles. I think we are losing the war. In some sense, that's not unique, I think, to the United States, although things are very, very bad here right now, given the particular political dynamic of the last few years. I think, you know, one of the values of this paper has been, I think, to get people talking and to point out the fact that sometimes we don't think deeply enough about the roots of the problems we are confronting. I see two main obstacles to progress in conservation. The first is a material obstacle, and that is that human beings for several thousand years now have committed themselves to the massive transformation of nature to support more human beings and to support higher levels of consumption, and we've created a set of institutions which are directed at growth, at transforming and changing nature to meet human wants. I won't say human needs, but certainly human wants. And certainly the anti-conservation movement takes tremendous advantage of this initiative, of this inertia. They're simply an extension of it, and they have all the resources of these institutions essentially at their beck and call to stand out in front of that inertia, if you will, to try to slow it and ultimately reverse it, is not a small task. We're talking about basic structural change, and that is certainly what's going to be required. And certainly the authors of the paper are quite right that no technical fix is going to work. The second major obstacle we face, I believe, is cultural. It's true that one needs vision, one needs an alternative to the existing visions, and certainly those opposed to conservation have been very good at creating a vision that appeals to people, but again, they're essentially tapping into the status quo, and that's a very powerful resource. They're essentially telling people what they want to hear, which is you can have your cake and eat it too, and it's okay for us to sort of behave in an irresponsible manner toward the ecological systems which support us. Conservationists and environmentalists have then a very difficult task, which is to create an alternative vision and to ask people to make some changes, and probably in some sense the most difficult change is to ask people to behave more responsibly. And you know, anytime you're asking people to change, to ask them to consider the unfamiliar, I always think back to our own Declaration of Independence and what Thomas Jefferson wrote about the way in which people are inclined to put up with bad relationships because they're familiar and are very reticent to make, at that time, what he considered to be revolutionary changes. But that's exactly, of course, what he and others were calling upon Americans to do. And people don't do that. People don't do that lightly.
What would you say would be the points that you feel offer the greatest insight into making these changes from the paper itself?
Well, I think they do recognize, I think very importantly, the need to look broadly, to look deeply, to challenge Americans and others more about these issues. Where I think they sort of overstate their case is they seem to not recognize that many groups do this. There's a lot more variety within the conservation movement than I think they give the conservation movement credit for. So I think they're certainly on the right track in that sense. But I think we need to go beyond. You know, they speak a great deal about the need for new values and a new vision, but almost invariably they seem to be talking about the cognitive. And I think that in itself is a real severe limitation. You know, the word emotion and the word motivate both come from the same root, which is to move. And I believe to be successful, what environmentalists need to do, what conservationists need to do, is to touch people's emotions, to touch their feelings. That's what moves people, not simply statements of value, not simply painting particular pictures of things, but to truly connect with people. People care for things. They will act on behalf of themselves, of their families, of other living things when they feel connected to them. And it's that connectivity, not just connectivity across the landscape, if you will, but connectivity of the human heart to nature that conservationists really need to help rekindle. The other thing that they point out is that we don't understand our audiences very well. And this is something that has been of long concern to me and I think to many others. Too often we talk to other audiences, people we'd like to get involved in the conservation movement, as if they were just like us. And people are not all the same. There's a lot of variety out there in terms of what motivates people, what stimulates their feelings, those kinds of things. And we really need to pay attention to that and to understand what motivates people so we can speak to them in a language that they understand.
You're one who champions the idea that we really must use the right story. You've been working on this. What kind of quote-unquote stories do you feel are effective?
Well, again, that's a, you know, that's a big question. I think that every society, every group in society has a familiar group of stories that they use to explain and understand the world. We sort of navigate the world through through stories. And one important first step in speaking to any group of people is to understand what their existing stories are and to try to examine ways in which what we're talking about makes sense in terms of the stories they're already telling themselves. It's not so much that we need to always invent new stories, but simply understanding existing stories and the way in which they're interpreted. I think if we look at the most recent presidential election, in which both sides had just about the same amount of money, but one thing that one side had that the other side didn't have was a coherent story about who they were and about what they wanted. And that generated great appeal. Well, the other side, John Kerry in this case, really lacked a coherent story. A lot of talk about the issues, but no capacity to really paint a picture of the world in which people could easily find themselves.
If you could begin the writing of that story, how have you explored this? Where have you gone with this? What is the story that you think may work to connect us and our emotions and our heart and our vision and our sense of well-being to this larger context of nature and then the environment?
Well, I think I'm not. There's perhaps an irony here, Sydney, in that while I recognize the value of stories, I may not be the world's best storyteller by any means. So, you and your listeners will have to bear with me. But I think the main story is one of empathy. The main story is one that allows human beings to see the world around them as not something different, not something that's sort of out there that they simply exploit or transform, but that nature is really part of what we need to consider our community, our home. And just as we take care of our home and we wouldn't, knock out a wall to take the 2x4s, to throw in the fireplace to stay warm for 15 minutes. We shouldn't treat nature that way. We shouldn't treat nature that way anyway. That ultimately it leaves us in a bad place. Ultimately, materially, we exhaust ecosystems, but it also leaves us very separated and alienated and not at home in the world that we are very much a part of. We've separated ourselves. It's the old word, alienation. I think a few years back to an NPR story in which Timothy Ferris, the astronomer, was asked why he thought people were so supportive of space exploration. And he said he thought, well, it was because people wanted to know whether or not they were really alone. And my first reaction to that was, how could anybody think they're alone? We're surrounded by life. Yet, many, many people do feel alone, and they find themselves gazing out at the stars, wondering whether they're alone and ignoring all the life around them. And I think the reason they're able to ignore that life around them is they don't see, they don't feel the linkages. They've been cut off. The empathy is no longer there. Things become objects.
I think we need to really craft our story. David Johns, I really want to thank you for giving your thoughts here on the Wildside News. David Johns is with the Wildlands Project. Dave, tell people how our listeners can find you.
We're on the web at www.wildlandsproject.org. That's probably the easiest. The mailing address is P.O. Box 455, Richmond, Vermont, 05477.
Is environmentalism dead?
No.
Maybe better crafting of language.
Among other things, yes. I think the article was, again, meant to get people's attention, and that it did.
Very good. Thank you, David, for being on the show.
Thank you.